Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a leadership gift from the Sutherland Family Charitable Fund. The Sutherlands support WHYY and its commitment to the production of programs that improve our quality of life. Additional support for The Pulse is provided by AstraZeneca and Independence Blue Cross.
We're not here to judge or punish or anything like that.
I mean, you don't have to run marathons. It's just like change ways of eating, be healthier.
Medicine 2.0, coaching, coaxing, Skyping, and reading your Facebook profile. I'm Mike and Scott, and this is The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation.
The galaxy we live in is on a crash course with Andromeda.
Beep, beep. Yes, you dream about it.
Giraffes don't faint.
No, they don't.
You just go about your life, and you don't notice a thing because it's just you.
Don't be so occupied with what you expect out of it, because that's bad science.
That's sometimes not so easy for somebody to let go.
Uh-oh. Uh-oh.
What happened?
Tomato started to hit me in the face.
Click here, stop. Nothing's interrupt this task.
No, I've got
you. You're just going to have a new cane or cane. Stand in a position that's not correct.
You know, MS is always going to be in your living room. It just shouldn't be in the center of your living room.
On today's show, a different prescription, how medicine is adjusting to new challenges. Is online chatting with a doctor better than an office visit? Will highly individualized care really reach all patients? And why do so many people not follow their doctor's advice? But first up, if there is a poster child for the growing challenges healthcare is facing, it's diabetes. Rates are skyrocketing. 29 million people in the U.S. have it. It requires medication and serious lifestyle changes. It's expensive to manage. It's chronic and progressive. So even if you do everything right, you could still lose a toe. It's associated with many other health problems like heart disease. It sounds terribly frustrating, right? Healthcare providers are finding new ways to keep patients on a healthy track, and sometimes they even score a win. Here's Tanya English.
This is what success sounds like. We're listening to a checkup at Puentes de Salud. The Bridges of Health Clinic is largely staffed by doctors and medical students who volunteer to work with patients coming from nearby Latino neighborhoods in South Philadelphia. Robin Canada is the medical director.
I'm so proud. Orgullosa.
Okay. Oh, my goodness.
Her patient is Blanca, who wants to use just her first name. Earlier this year, Blanca was diagnosed with type 2 diabetes. That means her body struggles to convert sugar to energy. When sugar backs up in the bloodstream, that can make you tired and irritable. And over time, diabetes hurts the heart and kidneys. Blanca's 5 feet tall and used to weigh 224 pounds, but Canada couldn't be happier with Blanca's progress today. She's exercising and eating better, and those changes have improved Blanca's blood sugar.
Okay, mire, cuando usted viene...
A test called A1C gives doctors a snapshot of blood sugar levels over the last 2 or 3 months. The numbers suggest how well a patient's diabetes treatment is working. This summer, Blanca's A1C was 9.2, which is dangerously elevated.
In junio, y ahora, mire, 6.3. Aquí.
Now she scores a 6.3. Canada says for someone with diabetes, that's excellent and pretty unusual. Often it takes months or years for patients to adopt better habits to manage diabetes.
Este es mi control de mi glucosa.
To explain her success, Blanca pulls out a small spiral notebook with page after page of scribbled numbers. Every morning and every night, she pricks her finger to test her blood sugar, then records the number in her notebook.
100.
Blanca has figured out the four pillars of diabetes management. Experts call them the four M's. She's watching what she eats. That's meal planning. She's walking more. That's movement. And the third M is monitoring, or keeping track of blood sugar. Medication is number four. Canada prescribed an anti-diabetes medicine, but what Blanca's doing and not doing at home makes a difference. So at the Puentes Clinic, patients and people at risk for diabetes work with lay volunteers called promotoras.
Mostly women basically help patients achieve their health goals and teach them about topics like diabetes and obesity and high blood pressure in a way that's much more culturally spot on than anything any of us could say.
Somehow in South Philadelphia, people know who we are.
Susana Pimentel has been a promotora for 10 years.
So they stop you, church, laundromat. I feel like it's my office now. Whenever I go do my laundry at church or whatever we are, people just stop you and ask you, can you make an appointment for me?
Puente's patients work long hours at low-pay jobs in pizzerias, bodegas, and factories. Pimentel says being poor and uninsured makes it harder to afford medicine and the right food. Promotoras meet with patients for healthy living lessons, and they give out their cell phone number.
I try just to say, please don't call me after 10, because they do.
In her neighborhood, everybody knows somebody with diabetes. Pimentel says if your grandmother has it and your cousin has it, some people feel like sooner or later they'll develop it too.
And we thought it was okay to have it in the family. It's like diabetes, okay, yeah, no problem.
Hi, my name is Rosalinda Hernandez, and I started to be promotora 4 years ago.
Rosalinda Hernandez and I spoke through an interpreter. She's most comfortable using Spanish, and Spanish is the language she uses to lead her classes at Puentes.
Porque muchas veces cuando ellos nos dicen, muchas veces la gente dice, oh, no sé por qué tengo mi azúcar alta si yo no como azúcar, si yo no tomo azúcar, o yo no como azúcar.
Lots of times people will say to us, well, I don't know why my sugar level is high, I don't eat sugar. And so that's why we say, well, tell me what you eat in a typical day. And then they might say, I eat bread, I eat cookies, but I don't drink soda. So then that begins the process.
Helping someone lose just 5 to 10% of body weight can delay the onset of diabetes. So Hernandez nudges people to roast chicken instead of frying, or try one piece instead of two. She covers the basics of meal planning and movement, but in her class, they also talk about another M, motivation.
Con ese autoestima.
And the self-esteem boost that they get, like, I look good, I feel good, like, I can wear the jeans that 10 years ago I wasn't able to fit into.
Almost everyone needs medicine and healthier habits to get diabetes under control. And research suggests that the kind of diabetes education that works best includes both one-on-one support and group classes.
Deborah brought up a good point. So we have wheat bread and we have white bread. Let's just say there is 3 slices of each.
Andrew Johnstone is a nurse and leads a 4-week diabetes academy at the health center where he works. It's run by the Public Health Management Corporation. The nonprofit group also hosts get-togethers for academy graduates. Johnstone says even his star students need reminders.
We do go to these events and it's like, ah, like they didn't remember that one key point.
Is it discouraging that they didn't know that?
That's a great question. I think I have to get told things lots of times, and it is hard, but it takes waves of learning this.
When you've ignored your chronic illness for years, diabetes class can feel like a harsh spotlight. People suddenly see how a lifetime of choices can take a toll on the body.
Some people go too hard. They say, like, I'm not going to have any more sodas. I'm going to check my blood sugar. I'm going to exercise. I'm not going to have any carbs or sweets.
But that kind of enthusiasm is hard to keep up. So Johnstone also teaches compassion and balance.
Chinese food and cake is okay, like once a month or something like that. And if you're monitoring your blood sugar, that's okay.
He says the care clinic is a place where graduates can keep coming back to learn from others in the diabetes community and to pick up new lessons when they're ready. For The Pulse, I'm Tanya English.
Tanya's story just illustrated how much work it takes to control a disease like diabetes. I think I already forgot the 4 M's. Motivation, meals, medications, I don't know. In a given year, managing an illness can add up to thousands of big and small tasks. Getting prescriptions filled, taking pills, cooking healthy meals, exercising. If you look at it this way, maybe it's not so surprising that the majority of patients struggle with following regimens to control their conditions. It's a number one complaint of physicians, and often patients who don't follow doctors' orders are summed up as non-compliant. But that's too simplistic, says our next guest, Dr. John Steiner. He's the senior director of the Institute for Health Research at Kaiser Permanente, Colorado, and he's one of the people shaping discussions on this topic. John, thank you so much for being here.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
So unpack the term non-compliant for us. What's all wrapped up in there?
Well, words matter, and I think the term compliance has come into disrepute in recent years because it so implies that the physician sets the standards or defines the terms, and the patient is supposed to simply follow what the doctor has said. A more common term these days is the term adherence, which some people still contend has a sort of paternalistic tone to it, but it tends to accentuate a little more the importance of patient judgment and decision in deciding how to take care of themselves and their medical conditions.
Ideally, should doctors and patients make a plan together for what the patient needs to do to stay healthy?
Yeah, I think this very much needs to be a collaborative effort. The physician has a lot of ideas based in the medical literature and their own experience about strategies that would be helpful to the patient. But ultimately, the patient is in the best position to determine what will work for them in their own context and their own situation. One of the things I often say when I'm talking with physicians about this issue is that we have to remember that ultimately patients have veto power over our recommendations.
What are some questions that perhaps physicians are not asking?
I think a lot of times we focus on the technical aspects of a treatment regimen for diabetes or other conditions and forget all the contextual concerns that patients have that guide their decisions. Questions like, do you have enough money to buy your medications? Do you have a safe place where you can exercise? Do you have enough money to purchase food? And if so, do you have access to the kinds of healthy foods that are recommended for people with diabetes? Those are the sorts of things we often forget to ask.
This is very frustrating for physicians, though, I imagine.
I think it is. We spend all this time acquiring technical training and expertise. And then when we talk to our patients, we realize that so much of what we recommend isn't carried out. And I think the first response is often one of frustration. But I think a deeper and more productive response is to then start to really analyze the situation and try to develop strategies that really do comprise more of a partnership.
Changing habits is a very difficult thing. I think all of us know that. If you've tried to lose weight or adopt an exercise regimen, it's hard. So do physicians think about that in their daily practice?
I think so. And when I'm talking to groups of physicians, I oftentimes try to bring the message home to them directly. I'll ask, how many of you have been prescribed a 10-day supply of antibiotics for an infection? And many of the hands in the room go up. Then I'll ask a follow-up question, which is, how many of you have taken them exactly as prescribed for the whole 10 days? And in that situation, many fewer hands go up.
How important is the relationship between doctor and patient? I imagine that if that relationship is good, it could really motivate patients.
Yeah, there's substantial research supporting that. Better communication between physicians and patients is associated with improved adherence. There are even studies, videotaped interactions between doctors and patients that look at kind of more egalitarian communication patterns where the patients are encouraged to ask questions and explore alternatives. And those sorts of communications are associated with better adherence.
Is there a danger that a physician will disengage from the patient, maybe even from, you know, feeling good about what they are doing when it seems like their patients are just not getting better and not really doing what it takes to get better?
There's certainly always that danger. I think, though, that the problem of what we call non-adherence is so common that any physician soon recognizes that this is in some respects the rule rather than the exception. And ideally, then, that really begins to change a physician's thinking from one of frustration that their advice isn't being accepted to really problem solving with the patient in hopes of achieving the outcomes that they really both desire.
John, thank you so much for talking with us.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
John Steiner is the Senior Director for the Institute for Health Research at Kaiser Permanente, Colorado, and he just mentioned how a good relationship can be a real motivation for patients to stay on a healthy track. Sometimes patients feel more comfortable around a doctor who looks like them, maybe even grew up in the same area. But for African American men, finding that kind of doctor is hard and getting harder. Last year, fewer African American men applied to medical school than in 1999. 1978. To find out why, reporter Lauren Silverman of KERA in Dallas talked to medical students and doctors who are bucking that trend.
After a long day with patients at the Veterans Hospital south of Dallas, Ovier Akbatare is unpacking groceries on his kitchen counter.
So I have milk and beef jerky, cereal, bananas, this random cucumber that I bought because Jeff bought a cucumber too.
Jeffrey Okanye is his friend and fellow fourth-year medical student at UT Southwestern. They're in a class of 237 people. Okanye points out only 5 are black men.
I knew the ones above us, below us, because there aren't that many in either.
Do you guys stick together as a group?
No, I wouldn't say we're like this large group of black males walking around. But we all kind of know each other. It's comforting to see another person that looks like you.
Here's the thing. There are more black men graduating from college in the past few decades. But when it comes to medical school, the number of black men applying has actually dropped from 1,410 in 1978 to 1,337 in 2014. That's according to a report from the Association of American Medical Colleges. Every other major minority group, Asians, Hispanics, saw growth in applicants.
I was really surprised by that. I sent it to my dad and my mom immediately.
Akbatare, who's studying internal medicine, says this isn't just a numbers problem. A lack of black male doctors could be bad for patients. Studies show people are more likely to follow doctors' directions on, say, medication or exercise if they can relate to them. Dr. Dale Okorodudu of Dallas says in a hospital, these things matter.
You can tell the way the patient looks at you, or they'll say things like, oh, I'm so glad to see you. And they'll say this behind closed doors, of course. And, you know, I have a blog that I wrote a few months ago about a patient who just saw me in the hallway and said, hey, brother, I'm glad to see you here. There's not enough of us out here.
Okorodudu has been trying to figure out why so few black men go into medicine. His conclusion? A lack of role models.
If you're a black male, let's say you're growing up in an inner city neighborhood, there's so many different things directly in front of you that you have the option to try to go into, whether it's various entertainment industries, music, sports, comedy, or whether it's getting involved with the church, or whether it's business. Those things are directly there in front of you. But when you're talking about the medical workforce, none of us are directly there in front of them.
Okorodudu decided to become a doctor at 18. A year from now, when he's done with his fellowship, he'll be 32. Med student Jeffrey Okanye says there are much faster ways to make it.
For example, I have friends, a lot of friends of mine, black males, are engineers. They go to school for 4 years. They have a job, great pay. They even had internships that I was highly jealous of. Whereas my route, 4 years of undergrad, then another 4 years of school, and there can be another X amount of years of training after that.
So why'd he take the long route?
I don't know. It's hard to describe the feeling you get when you make someone actually feel better, when you can see them go from one state to another and recognize that you were a part of this process of literally changing this person's life.
That kind of passion isn't the only thing Okanye, Akbatare, and Okorodudu have in common.
My mom was a nurse.
I got interested in medicine because my aunt was actually a doctor.
Particularly my brother Daniel, who's a doctor. He's been a mentor for
me
the whole
time. Yep, role models in the family. And all three are the children of immigrants from Nigeria. And this is a national trend. Think about it. That means the group of 1,337 black men who applied to med school last year looks very different from that group in 1978.
In 1978, those people that we're looking at, a lot of them are probably black American males of slave descent. Whereas individuals who are applying to med school now, a great number of them, like myself included, are actually Nigerian American, you know, people who aren't of slave descent. So if we actually broke it down that way, I'm sure that factoid is even more alarming.
Alarming, he says, because we're neglecting a sector of society, African Americans who've been in the U.S. for generations. That study we mentioned earlier suggests how to rebuild the pipeline, create more mentorship programs, invest in education at K-12 public schools, increase financial aid options, and convince med schools to put less emphasis on standardized test scores like the MCATs. Okorodudu is trying to fill the mentoring gap with an online service called Diverse Medicine. Users connect with mentors on chat or video. Sometimes, he says, the key to getting kids interested is simply seeing a black man in a white coat. For The Pulse, I'm Lauren Silverman.
This is The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. I'm Maiken Scott. We're looking at how medicine is changing today, how the field is keeping up with growing demands and new technologies. Our next story takes us to the outskirts of St. Louis, Missouri, to essentially a hospital with no beds. A big hospital system called Mercy Healthcare has just built the world's first freestanding center for telemedicine. Doctors and nurses there use a video conferencing system, kind of like Skype, that allows them to treat patients in hospitals as far away as Oklahoma and Arkansas. Often, that means emergency rooms in rural areas can have an extra pair of eyes when it's needed most. Duri Buscarin reports.
All right, what kind of labs are we getting? ABG, VBG, what else?
Her patient is in an intensive care unit at a hospital in Arkansas, and he's crashing. Dr. Vinaya Sarmadevi sits in front of six screens at a call center in St. Louis, directing a nurse through a video conferencing system.
I would rather you bolus that and stop the saline, because the saline is also very...
Sarmadevi stays with the nurse until an on-site doctor can get to the patient's room, eyes switching between a monitor that shows her patient's vital signs, medical records, and a real-time video of the patient in bed.
The clarity is amazing, especially with the monitors. We can even look at pupils to see if they're reactive.
She takes a break after she's able to hand off the patient to the on-site doctor. For Sarmadevi, the workday starts at 7 a.m., and for the next 12 hours, she'll keep tabs on intensive care units in hospitals as close as St. Louis and as far away as Oklahoma City. But hold on. Hospitals are full of doctors. Why do they need an extra one on a TV screen?
You know, sometimes people have cardiac arrest on the floor, right? And even an on-site physician could be far away from the bedside. If they just ping us, we can carry them into the room. And those first few minutes are very crucial.
So in emergencies, a virtual doctor can get there faster. At night, an urban hospital might be understaffed, and a rural hospital might not have a specialist close by.
The intensivist can recognize, you know, impending doom, if you will, and we can ask for the right person to come and help at the bedside even though we're not there.
The Intensive Care Monitoring Program, or EICU, is just one of the telemedicine programs housed at Mercy's new virtual care center, a four-story building on the outskirts of St. Louis, next to a highway and a suburban shopping mall. The floor where Sarmadevi works looks like a call center. About 100 desks are evenly spaced, each one with a privacy screen behind it. At any one time, there are dozens of doctors, nurses, and physician assistants murmuring into headsets as they check on patients in dozens of hospitals across five states.
Sometimes you can have technical difficulties, you know, because this is a camera in every room in the ICU. So if that one camera doesn't work at that time and the patient's really sick, that can happen.
The internet connection itself is hardwired, so the program doesn't have to rely on Wi-Fi. One lesson that was learned after a tornado devastated Joplin, Missouri in 2011, damaging a Mercy-affiliated hospital there. After her shifts in the EICU, Sarmadevi will go back to her regular job at a brick-and-mortar hospital nearby, and another physician will take her seat here in the virtual center.
A lot of times things get slowed down at night, so if it's not slowed down, these are the things. People are able to get out of the hospital earlier, get out of the ICU earlier, because someone else is watching them.
Watching and making adjustments.
A colleague of mine who was able to bring down the ventilator setting by the morning, just working very diligently, you know, over 12 hours, and the next morning the patient was doing much better.
This network of hospitals, Mercy Healthcare, has had some of these virtual medicine programs in place since the mid-2000s. What's new is that they're now housed off-site at this central location. One program keeps brain specialists on call, so if someone shows up in an emergency room with symptoms of a stroke, they can see a neurologist, even if the hospital they're physically in doesn't have one on staff. Another lets doctors check in with their patients after they've been discharged. Mercy has sunk more than $54 million into this building, even though telemedicine visits aren't always covered by health insurance plans. I got a hold of the president of Mercy Virtual, Dr. Randy Moore, and asked him why now.
The why right now is this has been an ongoing 10-year journey. The why right now probably makes more sense is that with value-based payment, if we can keep a person doing well at home, then the financial incentives are better than they've ever been.
The care itself becomes more efficient, Moore says. After all, they're moving electrons around instead of people. A spokesperson for the American Medical Association declined to comment for this story because he says virtual medicine is too new for the organization to have an established stance on the issue. The AMA does have a list of recommended guidelines for one-on-one telemedicine visits, such as physicians and patients should establish a face-to-face relationship before they conduct appointments remotely. But if telemedicine sounds like a cold alternative to an in-person interaction with a doctor, that's not always the case. Travel through the wires of the internet connection at Mercy Virtual, and you might end up here, in the Sleepy River town of Washington, Missouri, population 14,000. A cluster of vineyards are close by, and 87-year-old Naomi Coulter is showing off old family photos.
That's my brothers and sisters. That's all six of us girls.
For her doctor's appointment this morning, Coulter walks into her kitchen, a thin tube of oxygen trailing behind her. She's peering into an iPad where she and her doctor are trying to work through some technical difficulties.
Now, I can see your forehead. You're having a bad hair day.
5 days a week, Coulter checks in with her doctor or his assistant using Mercy's video conferencing system. She takes her vital signs at home, blood pressure, pulse, heart rate, and reads them off a piece of paper.
I was 158 over 70. My pulse was 83. My heart was 82.
Her doctor reminds her they've adjusted her medication. Until recently, Coulter had been in and out of the hospital every 2 weeks or so. The drugs she was prescribed made it hard for her to walk, and if she wanted to see her doctor, she would have to wait for an appointment. She credits Mercy's program with helping her stay at home.
Well, I hope to live to be 100 and still be able to boss my kids. I've got 13 years yet to work on.
And with more than a dozen grandchildren and great-grandchildren, she'll have plenty of opportunities to practice. For The Pulse, I'm Duri Bouscarin.
Duri is a reporter with St. Louis Public Radio. You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. Today, we're looking at how the field of medicine is changing to address new health needs among Americans. And we're going to stick with the issue of technology for a bit. If you look at your social media feeds, how many of your friends are rather forthcoming about their aches and pains and experiences with illness? Maybe they also share that they ate too much, drank too much, forgot to take their medicine. Now, what if healthcare providers had access to all of this info? Raina Merchant from the University of Pennsylvania School of Medicine has just conducted a research study on how much patients would be willing to share and what it could tell providers. Raina, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much.
So for this study, people who were coming to the ER were asked if they would allow access to their social media sites, right?
Exactly. So we were really interested in all of the information that people post online all the time, when you go to your Facebook and post something, when you tweet, when you upload a photo. And we wanted to see if patients would be willing to open up their social media accounts and share that information for the purposes of building a health research database. Really important in this process was that we wanted to link this data with information from their medical record. We wanted to be sure we could validate the data from their social media with things that were actually documented in their health records.
How many patients did you ask and what did they say?
We asked several thousand patients, and what we found is that of patients who do have social media, who used either Facebook or Twitter, many of them were actually willing to share both that data and their health records. So we found that over 70% of the people who had social media were willing to share that data and their health records.
Did that surprise you?
We were surprised. We thought that people would have more questions about those linkages. But interestingly, when we asked people, they said, I think that's actually interesting that my social media data may say something about my health. I didn't realize that. And they understood that in sharing this information, it wouldn't be an immediate feedback that they would receive, but that rather that this could contribute to a scientific database that could tell us a lot of things about a lot of people's health. And so people were interested in sort of being on the ground level and understanding and contributing to this science project.
So did you friend them on Facebook or follow them on Twitter?
Absolutely not. So for this project, we were very clear about we didn't want to interfere with people's normal sort of behaviors on their online platforms. So I work with folks in the computer science department who developed a specific app that would allow us to retrieve the information from their social media posts. And we had a process in place so they could see the information that we were going to receive. And we also made it very easy for them to remove the app at any time so that we would no longer have access to their data.
And what did you learn?
We had over 12 million words to analyze at the end of our several-month study. And so of these 1,000 patients, we had about 12 million words. Some of the information is very explicit. So patients may write about, oh, I feel like my asthma is acting up today, or, oh, I forgot to take my medication for my diabetes. Some of the information is a little bit more subtle, where patients may be posting about not going to work today, or that they feel like something is different, but they're not quite sure what it is, or they're posting about not wanting to hang out or talk to people or engage with people in the way that they normally would. And so our interest is in trying to understand how these differences over time may reveal things about their health.
All of this is very new, but in the future, what could you see this doing for you as a physician? How could this be helpful to you?
So I think the real opportunity in this data is, again, in being able to look at patterns across what lots of people actually post. And for a physician to use this information, it has to be both actionable and interpretable. I think in the course of my day, if I'm seeing patients, if I were to have a regular stream of their Facebook posts or I was constantly getting their Twitter messages, that probably wouldn't be helpful for me or for the patient. Nor is it clear that patients would want their physician to see that information. I think the real opportunity is, can we find new sort of patterns in this information that might tell us about onset of disease or disease progression that we could then use to provide tailored or targeted messages in a very personalized way for patients?
Could there be a future where we have perhaps a health coach who is our friend on social media and who tells us, hey, nice job with that lunch? Or
I think exactly. I think that would be really exciting. I think the opportunity is for the information that we're sharing to actually come back to us, and either we decide, oh, I realize that I'm posting more pictures of incredibly salty foods, or I haven't posted about exercising and I used to do that all the time. And either we get the message back and we can say, I want to do something about that, or your network gets a message and says, it seems like this person isn't posting in their usual amount, and we can actually send them a message to check in. Or actually the social media platform could take a role in providing resources to patients. I oftentimes see ads on the side of my Facebook page based on something that I just did. I'd actually like to see something that's really targeted and that could help me manage my health, potentially an access to a resource or a list or something that could be particularly useful besides just sort of product or targeted marketing in that way.
Raina, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Raina Merchant is a physician in the emergency department at the University of Pennsylvania School of Medicine, and she also heads Penn's Social Media and Health Innovation Lab. This is The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. I'm Mike and Scott. We're looking at new trends in medicine today, and here's something that could bring about a fundamental shift. In the beginning of this year, President Obama announced his Precision Medicine Initiative during the State of the Union address. For this initiative, 1 million patients nationwide will be followed for at least a decade. Researchers will map their DNA, their health conditions, environments, and lifestyles to better understand specific diseases and how treatments could be precisely targeted to the individual. But questions remain about who will benefit and who may be left out. People of color have often been underrepresented in clinical studies, and one leader of the Precision Medicine Initiative has made it his mission to include everyone. This may be especially important for specific diseases. From San Francisco, Ali Butner reports.
A smile flashes on 8-year-old Danea Smith's round face. She's soft-spoken but alert and loves to read anything she can get her eyes on. Here, it's posters on the wall of San Francisco General Hospital's pediatric asthma clinic. Smith has had asthma for as long as she can remember. And several weeks ago, just after a big birthday party, complete with ponies and a bouncy house, she was hospitalized with an acute attack. I ask her what that's like.
It's scary. And it's hard.
What's hard about it?
That you have to stay in the hospital for long and take lots of medicines.
Now she's here for a follow-up with nurse practitioner and clinic director Kimberly Honda.
I'm going to listen to you breathe, okay? So with your mouth open, I want you to take big breaths in and out.
Smith is considered a high-risk patient here because she has a history of severe asthma attacks. But she's also at greater risk simply because she's Black. African Americans are 34% more likely than Caucasians to have asthma and 3 times more likely to die from it.
Asthma rates differ dramatically by race and ethnicity.
Esteban Burchard, a doctor and researcher at the University of California, San Francisco, found that a gene associated with asthma severity was almost twice as common in Blacks as whites. And that might not be all. He says his lab has shown that people of different races respond differently to the commonly used asthma medication albuterol.
Based on that fact alone, it suggests to us that there are wide swaths of the population that are using a medication that largely does not work for them.
But the problem, he says, is that most medical studies have historically excluded people of color.
Research has focused in on populations that are easy to recruit. And those tend to be white patients. They tend to be the most affluent. They tend to have the most access, and they mirror the characteristics of the people doing the research.
Burchard isn't the first to recognize this problem. In 1993, Congress passed a law that mandated the National Institutes of Health to include women and minorities in all clinical research. But Burchard, suspecting the NIH had largely failed in this effort, co-authored a report looking at respiratory health studies for the 2 decades since that law was passed. He found that the numbers got better for the inclusion of women, but not for people of color. Fewer than 5% of the studies included patients from racial or ethnic minority groups.
And yes, that's a social travesty, but it's also a missed scientific opportunity.
Because just as some diseases operate differently in men and women, he says, they can operate differently based on race or ethnicity. Burchard wants to change the demographics of future studies to learn more about these differences. And he just might be able to. He's one of 15 people on President Obama's advisory team for precision medicine, a $215 million initiative the White House announced earlier this year.
What if figuring out the right dose of medicine was as simple as taking our temperature? And that's the promise of precision medicine, delivering the right treatments at the right time, every time, to the right person.
Precision medicine is a relatively new field that uses combined advances in genomics, medical technology, and big data to help target treatments based on a patient's type of disease, lifestyle, environment, and DNA. To get to that future the president talked about, though, his initiative needs to recruit at least 1 million people nationwide who are willing to share their health data with researchers for over a decade. How that 1 million-person cohort is going to look, says Burchard, is unclear. It will be overseen by the NIH, which Burchard says could bring up challenges from the past when it comes to including diversity.
But for precision medicine, we are trying to right the ship.
That's important for the future of racial equality in asthma treatment. Sally Wenzel, director of the University of Pittsburgh's Asthma Institute, says we already understand that African Americans and possibly Puerto Ricans are more likely to have a type of asthma that develops at a very early age and causes severe allergic reactions. But unlike Burchard, she's not sure yet whether race and ethnicity determine a person's response to albuterol.
I think we're a little too early to make those types of statements. We just need to understand the underlying molecular biology, whatever your racial ethnic background is.
She agrees with Burchard that clinical studies need to include more diversity, and her own research reflects it. Even though African Americans make up roughly 15% of the U.S. population,
we're actually at 30 to 40% of the cohort being African American because we feel that there is an enhanced need to study African Americans in relationship to severe asthma.
There are still big challenges to recruiting racial and ethnic minorities into clinical research. Kimberly Honda says her patients, who are mostly non-white, already juggle a lot in their daily lives. So when it comes to convincing them to participate in a study,
how does that actually make sense to a family who has spent 3 hours traveling to get to this clinic and has food insecurity issues and doesn't really know how to navigate from one clinic appointment to the next and has multiple children at home with asthma and are getting medications confused and parent doesn't really have time to give the medications. How does that really become a priority for them?
But for some, it has. Back in the clinic room, Danaya Smith's mother, Verna Stitt, tells me she's just enrolled her daughter into a study at UCSF designed specifically to improve asthma treatments for African Americans.
And if they can help her not have all these attacks and, you know, anything to try to help her get, you know, that's scary to me. So, and she's already taking the same medicine. So it's just like, why not try to help someone else, you know?
And that's the idea. If Burchard's precision medicine team can consistently reach families like this over the next few years, they may be building a long overdue bridge between the medical research establishment and the people who need it most.
Kite, bike, boat, goat.
For The Pulse, I'm Allie Budner.
That's our show for this week. We've been taking a look at how medicine is changing to adapt to new challenges and to adopt new technologies, and we would love to hear your take on this topic. Have you noticed any changes as a patient, or if you're a healthcare provider, are you doing anything differently? You can contact us via Twitter. We're at WHYY The Pulse. And if you missed any parts of today's show, just subscribe to our podcast. It's on iTunes. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening.
Supporting WHYY's The Pulse, AstraZeneca strives to create a culture where employees are excited by their work, have a clear sense of purpose, and display confidence in their ability to meet challenges and seize opportunities. More at AstraZeneca.com/careers.
Independence Blue Cross supports WHYY's The Pulse and strives to lead the way with a focus on preventing illness rather than reacting to it. They are proud to offer health programs, including fitness reimbursements and health coaches. IBX.com. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless. Ben Franklin Technology Partners of Southeastern Pennsylvania supports WHYY's The Pulse and are partners with a purpose, providing capital, counsel, and connections to technology entrepreneurs and investors in the greater Philadelphia area. More about Ben at partnerswithapurpose.org.